First Baptist Church of Redmond, February 6th, 2022, John Chapter 2, Turning the Tables.
Please rise and join me in reading John 2, 24 through 25. But Jesus, on his part, was not entrusting himself to them, because he knew all people, and because he did not need anyone to testify about mankind, for he himself knew what was in mankind. You may be seated.
Turning the Tables is the title of our message, John 2, 12 through 25. So, the New York Times has called Elon Musk arguably the most successful and important entrepreneur in the world. What case can be made? It's an easy case to be made. He's probably the only person who has started four billion dollar companies. He started PayPal, Tesla, SpaceX, and SolarCity. And they each have been worth $1 billion. But at his core, he's not a businessman or an entrepreneur. He's been called an engineer. He's been called an inventor. And his own words, as he puts it, a technologist. But in an interview with Rolling Stone magazine, Elon Musk was asked the following, and he was asked that by the interviewer first. His first three questions I've got, and I've written down the answer to these first three questions. Do you believe in God? His answer, I try to let the weight of evidence determine my opinion. Do you have a spiritual practice? Not really. I believe in science. What do you think happens when you die? I think you cease to exist. I'm hoping I've been wrong in a positive way, but most likely, you're just gone. I'm amazed that Rolling Stone interviewed him with these questions first. They have a more extensive interview, but he's not a man of faith yet. He's a man that only believes in what he can see, and he chooses not to see spiritual life. He's different than you or I, hopefully. The Bible says, after this, he went down to Capernaum, Jesus, he and his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there a few days. After this, the event recorded in the preceding paragraph probably occurred in late February or early March of that year. We guess that the events recorded took place in either 27 through 33 AD. We can't be precise with the dates. I think Jesus was born at adjusted calendar reading of 4 BC, but it doesn't really matter. But the Passover was going to be celebrated next. So that means that it was February or March, because he was going to go observe the Passover in Jerusalem next. After Cana's wedding, he proceeds to Capernaum, where he stayed a few days. He then follows the Passover festival, which was held in early spring, about April. But I wanted you to notice, we tend to forget that Jesus was part of a family. We guess that from the silence, the gospel writers does not talk about Joseph after announcing that he was born of Joseph. So we assume that Joseph is dead because he's never mentioned. Mary, his mention is mother, and Jesus had some brothers. And can you imagine what it would be like to have Jesus as your brother, physical brother? He was always right. He was always helpful. He always did the right thing, but he was perfect. So he's different than you or I. And I hope his family was tolerant of him. It records something different, however. His mother and his brothers used to be worried about him, living excessively zealous, living excessively to please God. And they thought, you shouldn't try so hard. Need to not worry as much. But he was part of a family, and he spent time with his family. That's important to notice, that Jesus honored his earthly mother, his family, and if they got married and had children after he was born and alive, he would have honored and observed his family and loved his family. So I want you to notice that Jesus has nothing bad to say about his family, and he has nothing bad to say about spending time with his family. And after his first miracle, he spent time with his family. And I think it was about a month. The Passover of the Jews was near, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Every male Jew from the age of 12 and up was expected to attend the Passover at Jerusalem. It was the most important festival that they observed. On the 10th month of Abib, or Nisan, which generally corresponds to our March, through its closing days, sometimes extend to our April. The calendar that observed was uncertain because it's a lunar calendar. And it depends on the phases of the moon when it was observed. A male lamb of the first year without blemish was taken, and on the 14th day, between 3 and 6 o'clock in the afternoon, it was killed, and it was eaten. The order of events would have gone like this. A prayer of thanksgiving by the head of the house, drinking the first cup of wine. The other cups were emptied as the feast proceeded. The eating of the better herbs as a reminder of the bitter slavery in Egypt that the nation of Israel observed. That's important to notice. This oldest son asked a question. Why is this night distinguished or different from all other nights? And the father would give an appropriate reply. He would tell them that God saved them and delivered their whole nation because they put blood on the doorpost and they marked them as under the blood. They would sing the first part of Psalm 113 and 114, and they would wash their hands. The carving and eating of the lamb together with unleavened bread. Whatever lamb you sacrificed, you had to eat in entirety. If there weren't many people in your family, it was okay to meet with another family and share the lamb. If multiple small families were gathered, they would share, because the lamb had to be eaten in entirety. The meal would continue, each one eating, but always the last of the lamb. It was totally consumed. And they would close it by singing the last part of Psalm 115 through 118. And within the temple grounds, he found those who were selling oxen, sheep, and doves, and the money changers seated at their tables. By this time, it had involved a scam. And that's why Jesus was so upset. And it's going to say, "Zeal for your house has consumed me," because it had been so commercialized that Jesus got angry. Jesus got angry. He was upset. Yes, he was angry because his father's house had become a place of business. And his father's house, the Jewish temple, was never supposed to be mostly about money. It was supposed to be an outreach point, a place to meet God, and a place to worship God. Each worshiper was allowed to bring his sacrifice, and he was allowed to select an animal before time. But let him try it. The priests made money off of the animals sacrificed if the worshiper brought an unacceptable animal. And by this time, it had devolved so much. It had evolved to the point that if you didn't buy an animal from the priest's selection, the priest's flock, it would be disapproved. You had to buy your animal, your bird. If you were poor, you could buy a bird and sacrifice it instead. But it had devolved to the point where if you didn't buy an animal of the priest's flock, A, it would be disapproved. B, you wouldn't make any money in the priest's family, and that's why Jesus was so upset, because it was bad business. He wasn't happy with the process of selling and having to buy something that would skim off of the people and fatten the priest's pocket. In all likelihood, it would not be approved by the judges, the privileged vendors who filled the money chests of the high priest. Hence, to save trouble and disappointment, animals for sacrifice were bought right here in the outer court, which was called the court of the Gentiles because they were permitted to enter. How would they know? They had to control the entry because if you brought your animal in, it would be disapproved. And they could tell because it would be disapproved and you could see the animal being bought from the vendors that would be working for the high priest. And that took room because imagine how many people would gather for Passover. Every Jewish male above the age of 12 would gather. So they needed room for the disapproved animals, and they needed room for the animals that would be purchased. It took room because the court of the Gentiles surrounded the court of Israel and the court of women, and it was supposed to be a means for anybody to come to the temple to watch. Anybody could watch God's worship, but there was no room because they took the room designed for the nations, the Gentiles, and filled it up with stalls and money changers. So it defeated the purpose. And within the temple grounds, he found those who are selling oxen, sheep, and doves, and money changers sitting at their temples. It must be borne in mind that only Jewish coins, specific Jewish coins, were allowed to be offered in the temple. And every worshiper, women, slaves, and minors excluded, had to pay an annual temple tribute, temple tax, of half a shekels. The money changers would charge a certain fee for every exchange and transaction. Here, too, there were abundant opportunities for deception and abuse. They would charge a fee to change money into a temple-used shekel. So they would skim money even in the transaction. And in view of these conditions, in the holy temple, intended as a house of prayer for all people, had become a den of robbers. You see it in Isaiah 56:7, Jeremiah 7:11, and it's referred to in the Gospels at Mark 6:11-17. And Jesus was so upset because they were abusing the house of God. He made a whip of cords and drove them all out of the temple area. Picture the scene. With the sheep and the oxen, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. Why did Jesus do it? They were not here to worship God. The temple became a house of business. And that was not the purpose of Passover. The purpose of Passover was to celebrate God's deliverance. But they were looking forward to the Passover, the high priests and the chief priests and the moneylenders, because it was an opportunity to skim the people. He made a whip. Favors the idea that Jesus actually drove out all the wicked traffickers together with the sheep and the oxen. In the second cleansing of the temple described in that passage, it is definitely stated that the cattle dealers will themselves be driven out. If that happened now, we may take for granted that it also took place now. So Jesus actually took a whip and drove all the people out, and he turned the money changers' tables over and made them stop. And to those who were selling the doves, he said, "Take these things away from here. Stop making my Father's house, a place of business." He paid special attention to notice the doves. I said, if you could afford it, you brought an animal, a bigger animal. But every male had to worship. And there's exclusion because the poor people, the ones who couldn't afford an animal, could buy something, and a dove, a bird especially, was acceptable. So he made a point of saying that he even drove out the people who would sell something to the poorest of them and told them not to keep overcharging. Filled with holy zeal, Jesus turned his attention to the money changers, and he threw their tables upside down so that he scattered their coins. And he said to those who sold the pigeons, "Take these things out." He told those who sold doves to remove the crates in which they were kept. "Stop making my Father's house a place of business," as it says in Zechariah 14:21. He exercised his right as the Father's unique Son. His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." The disciples, witnessing this manifestation of their Lord for the house of his Father, they were filled with fear that Jesus may suffer what David had to endure in his day, namely, that this zeal would in some way result in his being consumed. From this, it appears that Psalm 69 is messianic, because he quotes Psalm 69, "Zeal for your house will consume me." The Jews said to him, "What sign do you show us as your authority for doing these things?" The hostile Jewish authorities, they got mad because their source of income was limited. The hostile Jewish authorities now ask Jesus to vindicate his drastic action he has taken upon himself to act in the capacity of a reformer. Now let him prove that he had the right to act as he did. But this request was stupid. It was a definite fulfillment of Malachi 3:1-3. "The Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. He will purify the sons of Levi." And also was shown on verse 17 of Psalm 69. I quote it here, "For zeal for your house has consumed me, and the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me." Psalm 69:9. Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Here we have another mashal. It's the Hebrew word for a paradoxical saying. A paradox, a veiled and pointed remark, often in the point of a riddle. "I will raise up" is an expression used with respect to both reconstruction of buildings and the resuscitation of individuals. Resuscitation is a word that's used for making another one alive. For example, Lazarus technically was resuscitated. He was made alive from the dead. But Lazarus died again. He was not living in Argentina somewhere. He's not hiding. He was made alive, but he died again. The Jews, instead of jumping at the conclusion that Jesus is referring to nothing else than the physical structure which he had just cleansed, should have pondered, thought about this paradox. The Jews said, it took 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days? But they completely misunderstood and misinterpreted the wise saying, the paradox. Afterward, they had even twisted it as if Jesus had said that he himself would destroy the temple. You find that in Matthew 26:61 and Acts 6:14. It's interesting to note, however, that this grand structure was not finished until just a few years before it was destroyed by the Romans. The Romans destroyed it in 70 AD. But he was speaking about the temple of his body. John added these words because he realized that even among his readers, there might be those who would fail to understand that. For the reason already stated, the temple was a type of Christ's body. So that so when he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken. Because of the truth that had been cast in the form of a wise saying, a mashal, it lingered in the minds of disciples. Again and again, they turned it over in their minds. They struggled to understand many of the sayings of the Messiah. But until the day of Christ's resurrection, they failed to see and understand its meaning. No doubt this was due in part to their unwillingness to accept the fact that the Messiah would certainly suffer and die. Now, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover during the feast, many believed in his name as they observed his signs which he was doing. Jesus remained in Jerusalem during the entire Passover feast. It lasted about 8 days. Because of the manner in which his power was displayed, they accepted him as a great prophet and even perhaps as the Messiah. Many believed. This, however, is not the same as saying that they surrendered their hearts to him. Not all faith is saving faith. But Jesus, in their part, was not entrusting himself to them because he knew all people. Notice the contrast between many trusted and he was not trusting himself to them. The reason why he did not do this was because he knew all people, knew just what was in the heart of anyone with whom he would come in contact. And because he did not need anyone to testify about mankind, for he himself knew what was in mankind. It was not necessary for Jesus to listen to the testimony concerning any particular person. Why? He had already showed he knew Nathanael's thoughts. He knew Nathanael from the first chapter because he knew what was he reading in the Bible. He was reading about Jacob. And Nathanael suddenly believed in him because Jesus read his mind. His own penetrating eyes were able to look in the very depths of a person's heart. Take, for example, the next chapter. Nicodemus. Nicodemus was the most famous teacher in the nation of Israel. And he didn't understand the Bible until Jesus showed him the insight. And he became a believer in Jesus Christ. He's rare. He was a member of a Sanhedrin, and he believed in Jesus as their Messiah. Why? He came to Jesus at nighttime so he wouldn't be noticed, but Jesus saw he would believe. So John chapter 3, the famous 3:16, was said to Nicodemus. So Jesus had a lot of insight into his heart. So chapter 3 relates the story of Christ's conversation with this great Jewish leader. For us, by means of this temple cleansing, Jesus did the following things. He attacked the secularizing spirit of the Jews. By the way, one should not tamper with holy things. He exposed their graft and greed. He assailed the anti-missionary spirit because they were using the temple, the court of the Gentiles, for its unintended purpose. Everyone could come into the temple and watch and learn about God, but they took the space designed for the witness and used it to make money. The court of the Gentiles. Annas and his sons, the high priest, were using for their own selfish purposes that which had been designed and intended for a blessing for the nations. And he fulfilled a messianic prophecy in Psalm 69 and Malachi 3. I want to take your time to imagine a basketball game. It's almost the end of overtime. It's time for one last shot. Who do you want to have the ball? You want the calmest and best player out there. Or imagine the security of the nation is threatened. Threat levels have gone through the roof and an attack is imminent, like in the Ukraine. What do you want to, who do you want to have the nuclear codes? Who do you want to be making a final call on what to do or not to do? You want someone who is calm under pressure. Or here's one more example. Imagine you need a crucial surgery to save your life or the life of someone you love. Who do you want to have behind that scalpel? Who do you want performing the surgery? Of course, you want the best and most calm doctor available. That's how the Gospels present Jesus as he faces the cross. He's under extreme pressure, pressure that we can't even understand. He's actually sweating at one point drops of blood because he knew, he understood what he was doing. And yet, At every stage, Jesus is calm. He's in control of himself. But Jesus also leaves every sports star, every politician, every surgeon far behind. It's not that Jesus is in control of himself. Jesus is in control of the events themselves. It's not just that he's able to handle his own adrenaline. He's able to dictate the result. It's not that just he's able to act wisely under pressure. He's able to determine the actual outcome. Jesus isn't just able to respond skillfully to what he finds. He already knows what he will find, and he was already mapped out the solution to the deepest problem of all. Jesus stands out because he is in control of the entire sweep of human history, even as he goes through his death. Jesus was betrayed, Jesus was crucified, and Jesus took up life again. He offers that life to us.